solid gold. This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Clinchfield, Coltrane, pulling so slow. Clinchfield, Clinchfield, pulling so slow. Hoping all the poor people won't know how much coal you've stole. When I die, Lord, bury me cold down by that stinking NW.
Hello, and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we bring you interviews from the Black Jewel Miners Blockade, as well as an interview with Kentucky artists Ken Swenson and Lacey Hale, and a story about cats.
Coal cars empty coming back, taking all our wealth away, the profits do not stay.
Beginning on Monday, July 29th, laid-off miners, their families, and supporters began blocking a coal train on the tracks outside Cumberland, Kentucky. Miners blocked the train demanding that their bounced paychecks be paid by their now-bankrupt former employer, Black Jewel. The situation has been changing rapidly, but the protest, which has lasted for over a week, is significant for mining communities across Central Appalachia. WMMT's Sydney Bowles spent time at the blockade, and we bring you the following interviews. First, with Curtis Kress, a laid-off miner who Sydney spoke with on Thursday, July 1st.
John Curtis Kress, I was a fire boss slash pre-shifter belt examiner for Cloverlick 3 on their day shift crew.
So you were telling me just now that, like, the thing that you don't like the job, but that you wanted to do something else, but then this is sort of what happened. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, like I'd said before, you know, coal mining has never been something I wanted to do. It was part of my, I guess, heritage, you know, my dad and papaws and all that had always done it. And I'm proud, you know, of that heritage, but it's just something I didn't want and don't want for my kids. But
can you
just
talk about why?
The uncertainty. It's, you never know from one day to the next if you're going to have a job. They'll get you used to making a whole lot of money and then kind of take it away. And you always have to look for a job. And a lot of people say it's either steak or bologna. You don't ever know from one day to the next. And it's not really a safe job. And it's always just slowly killing your body. You know, no matter how many regulations or whatever there are, nobody really, I don't know. You can't really do everything in order to protect your body the way that you should. So, I mean, you're always just slowly killing yourself with a job. So by the time if you do make it to retirement age, you're not going to be able to enjoy nothing. It's just not really a good career.
That's like, I don't know, I'm not from around here. I moved here like 9 months ago now. And I feel like, I've pretty much only heard people say, like, coal mining's in my blood. Like, this is what has kept our community alive. And, like, you're pretty much the first, like, coal miner that I've talked to who has said something different. Like, how common is your perspective, do you think?
I don't know. You know, I think a lot of those guys, like, that, you know, they say it's in their blood. I may be wrong, but I almost want to think that, you know, that's what they want to do, you know? I don't think they wanted anything else. I think they were so proud of their heritage, you know, that they just wanted to continue that, which, you know, that, I mean, I can understand that completely. But, you know, I've just seen so many people, you know, that are so, you know, back broken and, you know, can't breathe and are down from it, that it just didn't seem like something that I just wanted to be a part of, you know.
What do you think is, like, the legacy of coal mining in eastern Kentucky? Like, what do you think, like, long-term, do you think it's been a net positive, a net negative? Like, why? Do you know what I'm trying to ask?
Not for sure.
like, I don't know. I mean, you're talking about the cost that mining has on your body,
right,
and the uncertainty of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sort of the environmental cost, mm-hmm, and, you know, different costs that you pay and that communities pay down the road.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, coal mining has, like, sustained families for generations. And so I, like, since I'm not from here, I've been thinking a lot about what do I think is, like, what has been the cost and what has been the benefits and what's the cost, and I'm trying to figure out, like, where that balances out. But I'm not the person who would know, you know? Like, it's guys like you.
I'm not really for sure. I mean, when the coal market was up, you know, it all, you know, businesses came in, you know, it was, I guess, a booming area, not just here in Harlan County, but Harlan County, Letcher County, Perry County, you know, all the surrounding counties that actually had, you know, active coal mines. You know, when the market was up, you know, businesses were booming, people were, you know, buying vehicles, buying houses, and you know, going on big vacations, you know, and you know, everybody was receiving money was going back in the community. And then when the coal market falls, you know, nobody's got the money to spend, so all the small businesses, you know, have to get forced out, and the big corporations are about the only thing that gets to stay. It's just in this area where coal is, you know, the only, I guess, resource for jobs and careers. I mean, it's just the economy wise, you know, it's been an up and down for us as long as I can remember. And from what I gather from talking to, like, the old timers, I guess you'd say, you know, that's same thing with them. You know, it's a never ending up and down cycle from everything. I don't know if that helped answer any or not.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to know, like, what do you think is the future?
I've never thought, really, I guess, that coal was always a certain future, you know. Eventually, you know, with the different, I guess, regulations and changes, you know, people trying to convert everything from coal burning over to, you know, different fuels and resources, you know, eventually, I think coal will, you know, maybe be obsolete in a sense. I mean, I'm sure that it'll be used somewhere, but it won't be such a demand as it is at certain times, you know. So, unless there's something else to come in here, you know, then it's just not something, you know, to rely on, I guess you'd say.
Curtis, I'm so sorry for the question I'm about to ask you. This is terrible. You're going to hate me. You're going to want to punch me in my face.
I doubt it.
Last night was the second night of the Democratic debate in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I fell asleep partway through, but I got the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of talk about phasing out coal,
mm-hmm,
by 2050 or 2040, I think, maybe, mm-hmm, even 2030 by some of them. That would be a big, big problem for this part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel comfortable, and I know that this is a really fraught conversation, can you tell me what you think about sort of the national politics side of this? Like, do you think the Democrats are sort of right to be talking about phasing out coal in 20 years? Do you think Republicans are right in trying to bolster the industry? What do you think?
Well, as far as politics go, I mean, there's politics involved in every, you know, everything. It doesn't matter what it is. And as far as the party side goes, you know, one party will, you know, decide to, you know, the Democrats right now saying that, you know, they might be trying to campaign to reach a certain group of people, you know, to draw more voters or whatever, you know. We're on down the line, Republicans might be saying the same thing, you know. I don't think all Democrats believe one thing, Republicans believe another. But as far as it phasing out, I mean, they may be right. You know, that's like what I was saying. You know, I don't see it lasting forever. But I'm not real into the whole politics side of everything as far as party wise go. You know, I believe in what's right, and that's just what I go by.
Do you feel optimistic or pessimistic about the future of Appalachia, and why?
I'm always a glass half full person, so I always try to look for the good in everything. I feel that eventually, that something will come in here. You know, right now there's millions of dollars worth of road work going on in Hazard to better capacitate the volume of traffic for factories to be able to come in, because right now they have a great site in Perry County for factories. There was factories at one point in time, but they have great prime real estate for other factories to go in, and supposedly I think an aluminum factory is supposed to go in next year. So I'm always optimistic about, there will be stuff come in here. It's not just going to be a place that'll dwindle down to, shacks and, people just living off the land. I don't think it'd be nothing like that.
What's next for you right now? How are things for you and your family?
Well, honestly, about to lose everything I got. We had went through kind of like a little speed bump in my family, right before all of this, and they were going to foreclose on my home, and we had to make an agreement because I'm also in active bankruptcy, so our lawyer had made an agreement with my bank that my mortgage is through, and we were going to double up on house payments and catch everything back up. And once we made the agreement the very next week, then I didn't have a job. Luckily, I was able to get unemployment, but my unemployment is roughly $1,000 a month. And I have, three times more that needs to go out than what I have coming in.
You seem real calm.
Like I said, I'm always an optimist. There's no use in getting depressed. You can't crawl back into a hole and just, I guess, hide and say, poor, pitiful me. You've got to just keep moving and just hope that, something good will come out of something, and just keep fighting.
That was Curtis Kress, a miner participating in the Black Jewel Miners blockade, recorded by WMMT's Sydney Bowles on Thursday, July 1st at the blockade. Sydney also spoke with Curtis's wife, Felicia Kress, on Monday, July 29th, the first day of the blockade.
Yeah, so can you tell me your name and what brings you out here today?
My name is Felicia Kress, and my husband was a worker over here at Revelation Coal in Harlan County.
Can you say what's on your sign?
No pay, we stay. And the reason behind that is my husband worked two whole weeks straight without a day off. And whenever he finally got a day off, it was around the 4th of July, that Friday. He, got his payday, cashed it, came home. On Saturday morning, we were alerted that our banking account was overdrafted $3,000 in the hole. And we're responsible for that. The bank came out and told us, if we don't pay it, we're going to jail. But here's this hoops man that has wrote hundreds on top of hundreds bounced checks freewillingly, knowing that they were bad checks, and he's federally getting by with it. I mean, my mind can't wrap around that. I don't understand how that's possible. And that money that they took out of our banking account was taxed money that my husband worked for. This man has worked a job that sucks, that hardly anybody would want to work, but he done it anyway for us, for me and my kids, and to support us. And this Jeff Hoops comes in and takes food out of my kids' mouth, and the sweat off my husband's brow. And in life there's three things you don't mess with a woman, and that's her kids, her man, and her kitchen. And he messed with all three of them, so
But, like, what does it mean to you that there's, like, a truck full of coal that's, like, coming down the tracks while you guys are operating?
To me, that speaks for itself, you know. Where would this coal be going if we wasn't standing here? If we wasn't making a statement, where would all this money be going to? Who's getting all of it? Because we're not. These men that worked for it ain't getting nothing from it. And, you know, as far as I can tell, we've not gotten any help, you know, other than our communities coming together and helping these men that, that have worked and made an honest living. And it just, it saddens me, really. And then I get angry because, you know, this has caused my family pain and suffering. School's gonna start back, you know, and I'm blessed that I have family, you know, that will help us. But, you know, when you got a $2,000 power bill and a mortgage payment and no money coming in, and money that he has worked for that was taxed money, you know, that's what upsets me the most. And I get aggravated and angry. And honestly, I want Jeff Hoops to feel the wrath of a wife and a mother because he's done so many of these men wrong. Not just the men, but their families as well, you know.
Clinchfield coal train pulling so slow. Clinchfield, Clinchfield pulling so slow. Hoping all the poor people won't know how much coal you've stole. When I die,
next up, I spoke with Kentucky artists Ken Swenson and Lacey Hale about Ken's exhibition of prints, which are showing in the Appleshop Theater from July through August 2019. We also talked about the collaborative art zine making workshop taking place at the Appleshop Boone Building on August 22nd, 2019, from 3:30 to 9 p.m.
Hi, my name's Ken Swenson. I'm a printmaker from Maysville, Kentucky, and I was really excited to be invited to the Apple Shop to do a printmaking show.
My name is Lacey Hale. I am an artist full-time. I live here in Letcher County. I'm from Knott County, but I've lived in Letcher County for several years now.
If you could sort of describe for listeners who haven't seen your artwork, what can people expect if they come see this exhibit?
This shows includes a variety of different relief style prints, including lino cuts and wood cuts that I've done over the last couple of years. A lot of my themes are rural scenes and river scenes.
I noticed when you were first hanging the show that there are multiple sheep prints because I grew up on a sheep farm. So oh, they yes. caught my attention pretty quickly. But there's a lot of animals in this exhibit downstairs. There's like some squirrels and some rabbits and some sheep. And I'm just curious if that's kind of a common theme that you make art out of. And you were saying you make rural things, but there's a lot of sure. animals.
Well, I love country scenes and I love animals. I sometimes have fun making images with animals doing things a human might normally do, like a squirrel riding a bicycle or a animal playing a guitar or a fiddle.
Yeah.
Some of them were very whimsical. Yeah. It's a really fun exhibit, I think. There's some
playful.
Very playful pieces downstairs.
Yeah. And what is relief printmaking for people who don't know even what printmaking is or what the different kinds of printmaking are?
Well, printmaking's another art form, just like painting or ceramics or sculpture. It's unique in that it was one of the early mass medias. You would use printmaking to get a message out, for example, a poster.
Lacey, you can jump in too.
Sure. Printmaking, you're usually carving a design into a block, either wood or linoleum. There's like this stuff called soft cut, but Ken, most of the work downstairs is what wood cut and lino, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So it's basically like you're making a stamp, but it's a really cool meditative way of like creating a piece of artwork that you can replicate over and over and over again. So you have your design, you transfer it onto your block, and then you carve out what you don't want to print and leave whatever you want to print raised up. So, you know, it can take a really long time or it can, you know, something be really like quick and fun. And so I think it translates well when people see it. Printmaking translates well to people that aren't really familiar with art. And they also, I always love teaching that kind of workshop because people seem to really like to try like this certain type of art making. So, I think printmaking is something that's very well received to the general public,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And accessible.
It's
a new way to start if you're trying to learn.
Yeah, accessible is a great word. Yeah.
So it's my understanding that the exhibit is having a big closing event that's also sort of a collaborative zine making, is that right?
That's right.
So what's that like? What's that mean? What, you've done this before.
Sure.
How does it work?
In the spirit of printmaking and it being art for everybody, we decided we wanted to do some kind of community outreach as part of the exhibit. And 2 years ago, I did a project called Art Zine. And the way it worked, every month I would visit a different small town and I invited the people who lived there to meet with people who wanted to visit that small town. And together we made a little magazine out of 8.5 by 11 paper. And we had people participate who were poets and artists and photographers. There were some people who didn't identify as visual artists at all, but they would make a crossword puzzle to go in the zine. After rethinking it, I've decided to do it quarterly instead of every month. And I thought that there was no better place to kick it off than here in Whitesburg at the Apple Shop.
When is it happening? What time is it? What should people know about it if they want to participate? Do they need to bring supplies? How is it going to work?
Well, it's happening in the Boom Building across the street from Apple Shop. So, and it's on August 22nd from 3:30 to 9, I believe is the time we had set. So it's going to be a pretty long workshop. Apple Shop can provide some refreshments, so we'll have some drinks and snacks there. So this is basically acting as the closing reception of this exhibit. So I think that's, we've never had a project like this or an exhibit like this that has culminated in this like group art project. And so I think that's very cool. And we'll have art supplies there. There's some already at the Boom Building that we can use. Ken's going to bring some of his own. And if anybody wants to come to Apple Shop and look at the exhibit downstairs, you can kind of see, I mean, you can definitely see the kind of work that Ken does, but you can also look at some of the past art zines. There's a display down there that, there's several down there that people mm-hmm. can look through. And there's also a map that shows where, you know, they have been made in the state. So it's really cool.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, after a devastating week of mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, we wanted to bring some levity to the show. And so, we're showing appreciation for the cat lovers in our listening audience. August 8th is International Cat Day. So from producer Aaron Henkin, we bring you Cat Show, an afternoon spent wandering the aisles of the Cat Fanciers Association's exotic cat show in Baltimore County, Maryland. This story aired originally during a local arts and culture special on WYPR in Baltimore, Maryland in 2004.
This is a story about the truly fanatical cat lover. The feed-your-cat-gourmet, freeze-dried meat kind of cat lover. The buy-your-cat-its-own-plane-ticket-so-it-can-ride-next-to-you kind of cat lover. This story is an audio portrait of an extreme and, to some, a bizarre sort of true love. The pure, unadulterated, blind, and unconditional love between a human and a pedigreed feline. Welcome to the Gymnasium of the Community College of Baltimore, Essex Campus, site of the Cat Fanciers Association Exotic Cat Show.
How are you? Can you say hi? No? Chor-chor. Come here.
They don't open their mouth. They just go, And we have these wonderful conversations. Tori.
What's her name?
That is Grand Champion E-Mouse Fly By Night, and she goes by Bug.
And she's like a national champion best of breed?
At this point, she's best of breed Egyptian Mau in the country.
Wow. Do you think she's developing an ego about that?
Well, she's always had an attitude, but it's always been a very happy-go-lucky, friendly attitude. Confident.
And what are these guys' names?
The exotic is Johnny. The cream point Himalayan is Crystal, and the white Persian is Gigi. The exotic is actually what they call a lazy man's Persian. He has a Persian body and type, but he has a very short plush coat that stands away from his body.
They also have like a pretty distinctive face.
It's very short, with a break between their eyes above their nose. And their ears are tiny and low, and everything is supposed to be round.
Yeah, it kind of looks like their face is pretty much smashed in.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe that expression?
His? Uh-huh. Well, he looks kind of grouchy right now.
That's the All Green Kitten Finals, Ring 5. If you are in another ring, please let us know and come when you are available.
Now, you've got like a beauty table here. What kind of treatment do they get before they go into the judging ring?
They get their faces cleaned off, and the Persians especially get combed so that every hair stands in place. They're not separated, they're not oily, they're not greasy. Every hair needs to be just right in place, like she just did come out of a beauty parlor.
When I showed a Persian, I gave him a hot oil treatment every week.
Oh, okay, with like VO5 or whatever.
Exactly. Uh-huh. That's exactly what I used. He loved it. Okay, it's a lot of work. It used to take me 3 hours to bathe and blow dry the Persian for a show.
How does a cat react to being blow-dried?
He loves it. You start doing that when they're very young. If you have a cat with show potential that you think is going to be good enough to run, you start them out getting bathed at 8-10 weeks to get them used to it. It gives you very quality time with the cat. I come home from a bad day at work and, you know, bathe him, and I can forget about it, and it's a bonding time.
To say, you know, I've been through all these aisles, and this is probably the most elaborate sort of mobile cat home that I've seen yet. What are we looking at here?
It's just some pictures of our cats. We have Sphinx cats, and it's a little statue on the top that looks kind of Egyptian themed. And we just have a little table on top with the pictures sitting on it, and then our collapsible cat crate that they all travel in.
And it's all in a sort of a royal purple with sort of a sequins canopy on top and purple flowers as well.
Yeah, my wife's favorite color is purple, as you can sort of tell.
The first thing that the untrained eye is going to notice about this cat is?
No hair. Yeah, her name is Bella, and she's a Sphinx. She's very sweet, but she has no hair.
Now, she looks also very wrinkly. Is she old?
No, that's part of the breed standard for Sphinx. They're supposed to have a lot of wrinkles, especially on the top of their head.
Now, how would you describe the expression on her face?
Inquisitive, relaxed. She's content.
And a little intimidating, I think, as well.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
She looks a little bit like, kind of like E.T. from the side.
Oh, yeah.
These are all the cats that we just saw being judged over at the other end of the room, right? And they were all sort of judged along what sorts of standards?
I think that one of the defining characteristics of the Egyptian Mao is not only the spots and the coat, but that beautiful expression, what we call the worried look. And the Mao should look like, oh no, I just missed the bus. And if you look at, you know, that the girl that took breed there is the one right in the middle, and she's got that just incredibly, oh my goodness, you know. That's almost, it's not startled, because you don't want a round-eyed look. You want a pregnant almond for the eye. But you want it to look very concerned, you know. The weight of the world is on a mouse's shoulders.
Now, the one that's fun to watch is 17. Because she gets out there, and she's always doing happy feet, no matter what. She's just, if you look, you can probably see her doing, she just doesn't care, just happy, happy, happy.
Cat exhibitors Debbie Kenny, Lori Coughlin, Melanie Morgan, Pam Huggins, John Euler, and Rose Spillman gathered together along with scores of other cat fanciers to show their exotic cats on the weekend of January 10th in the gymnasium of the Community College of Baltimore Essex campus.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. Music features Rich Kirby and Michael Klein with a tune called Coltrane Song from their June Apple record, They Can't Put It Back. If you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org. Or download Mountain News as a podcast from SoundCloud or Stitcher. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.